Johnson has written a second volume of memoirs, Please, Mr. Postman, chronicling the career that took him to high office as a senior government minister. At the start of the 1980s, he finds political life making increasing demands on his personal life.
As I was elected to the Executive Council of what had become the Union of Communication Workers, the effects of the Thatcher government's policies were starting to be felt across the country. On the Britwell, the estate where we lived, the opportunity presented to council tenants to purchase their homes with the help of a government subsidy was a perfect example of a political decision having a direct and significant impact on people's lives. For Judy and me, and our neighbours and friends, the debate over the right to buy scheme wasn't some dry academic discussion of political pros and cons. We were the council tenants government ministers were talking about when they spoke of the transfer of capital wealth from the state to the people. It was undoubtedly a political masterstroke for the Conservatives, one that resonated with people more profoundly than almost any aspect of government policy I could remember. The effect around our small corner of the Britwell was immediate. Martin and Karen next door were the first to take advantage of the scheme. They would be free from the rules stipulating that no private hedge could be higher than 3 feet 6 inches and that your front door had to be a certain colour. They could paint their front door any colour they liked. They could change the door altogether if they wanted. Any improvements they made to their house would not have to be ripped out when they moved on, which was what happened to the properties owned by the council, the aim being to ensure that no tenant was given an unfair advantage. I recall one passionate discussion at one of our neighbourhood parties. My friend Mick Pearson, who joined the Labour Party with me, argued fiercely in favour of the scheme. I can picture us now, Mick in a vest with an earring in his left ear. He had been one of the first to participate in the masculinisation of the earring. His gin and tonic stacked with accumulated slices of lemon, Mick was wiping the floor with my carefully constructed argument that this was a bad policy that would have serious consequences for future generations. Why should we spend the rest of our lives paying rent that would eventually exceed the value of the house, only to see the home we'd cherished through decades handed on to someone else after we'd popped our clogs, he argued. Labour was wrong to oppose what Mrs. Thatcher was doing. It would cost us votes and lose us the next election. For Judy and me, the advantages of participating in the scheme were clear. To buy a house privately would require a hefty deposit. While we earned enough money to live reasonably comfortably, with no debts, a car, and a holiday every year in Cornwall or Devon, we had little in the way of savings. As tenants for over 10 years, we'd qualify for a discount on the value of the house of over a third. It was a cut-price bargain that was difficult to resist. But resist it we did. I felt no piety about bucking the trend among our neighbours, and our decision certainly had nothing to do with Labour Party policy, which speedily changed in favour of council house sales anyway. I didn't feel in any way morally superior to the people desperate to own their own homes, who saw Mrs. Thatcher as a liberator. What convinced us, in the end, was remembering how lucky we felt to have been allocated a council house. When I argued with Mick that we had an obligation not to deny future generations that lifeline, it wasn't mere rhetoric. I meant it. My mother's dream of having her own front door, of whatever colour, could only have been made a reality through social housing. Hers was an ultimately futile desire. Ours had been fulfilled. If our financial situation improved to the extent that we could afford a deposit, we should buy a house away from the estate and pass on what we'd been fortunate enough to acquire to another family who had no prospect of buying any kind of house. We declined to take advantage of the bargain offer and remained council tenants. I attended my first Labour conference in 1982, when Michael Foot was leader. I was an admirer of Foot's, and particularly of his masterly biography of Nye Bevan, but he couldn't command a party that was increasingly losing touch with reality. By coincidence, our son, Jamie, met Foote that year while doing his paper round. In the run-up to a by-election in Beaconsfield, the safe Tory seat that embraced a third of our estate, Jamie came running home one day, breathless, to tell us that he'd seen Michael Foote in Wentworth Avenue and he'd said hello. Foote had been with the Labour candidate. Jamie couldn't remember his name, but he too had said hello. That candidate's name would become rather better known. It was Tony Blair. Long before I did, my 10-year-old son met the man who would turn Slough back from blue to red 15 years later. Mrs. Thatcher's government formulated legislation to outlaw the closed shop, to make ballots before industrial action compulsory, and to force trade union general secretaries to stand for election every 5 years. These were measures that trade unions should have agreed with previous Labour governments, but had refused to consider. Far more important to the working lives of my union members was the announcement in July 1982 that British Telecom would be privatised. Whereas postal services were highly regarded by the public, the same could not be said for telephones. The long wait for installation and repair, plus the lack of choice of handsets and so forth, contributed to the unpopularity of the status quo. At the post office, a more forceful management style geared to higher productivity and less consultation had blown away the consensual approach to industrial relations that had existed since the war. Alan Tuffin had taken office as General Secretary of the Union in a climate so far removed from the one in which Tom Jackson, his predecessor, had operated that he might have been doing a completely different job. When Tom had handed over responsibility to Alan, he'd pointed to a second telephone on his desk. It was white and not the same model as the normal office phones. Tom told Alan that this was a hotline, the number of which was known only to certain government ministers and senior civil servants. "When that phone rings," Tom said, "it will be to consult you on matters of state. Industrial matters, certainly, but your opinion will also be gauged on wider political issues, such as the economy or overseas trade." When Alan retired 10 years later, he told me wistfully that during his entire decade as General Secretary, the white phone had rung only once. The caller had been a woman, asking if this was Sainsbury's. I was on the Southern Regional Executive of the Labour Party when the Thatcher government won its second term in power. In our region, the SDP Liberal Alliance had beaten us into third place. By this time, being part of the trade union movement felt like being under siege. The government wanted free, independent trade unionism, but only in Poland, where solidarity was challenging the totalitarian regime. In Britain, all the structures of consultation with the TUC had been abandoned. Alan Tuffin told me that when he'd gone with the General Council to make representation to the Treasury, the Chancellor, Nigel Lawson, had pulled a nail clipper from the pocket of his colourful waistcoat and rocked back and forth on his chair, manicuring his nails, while Norman Willis, the TUC General Secretary, made his presentation. By the mid-1980s, I was spending more and more time living out of a suitcase. I would be away from home for at least 8 complete weeks a year at conferences or the union's residential schools where I tutored. In addition, I was travelling abroad as a fraternal delegate to the conferences of sister unions. I was at the 1985 Labour Party conference in Bournemouth when Neil Kinnock made his dramatic speech denouncing militant. His bravery can only be fully appreciated by those in the party who'd witnessed the madness inflicted by those far-fetched resolutions pickled into a rigid dogma, outdated, misplaced, irrelevant, to which Neil referred. Slough had its militant caucus, but we weren't as badly affected as many other local parties were. At that time, any Labour Party member with a Scouse accent was assumed to be militant. In the union, Billy Hayes, the young Liverpudlian, who'd been instrumental in bringing Tony Benn to our conference, was becoming an increasingly important figure and constantly had to deal with such misconceptions. Billy wasn't, and never had been, part of this faction, and to be a young union activist in Liverpool, resistant to militant, didn't make for an easy life in the city in the 1980s. But the opposite of militant is moderate, and Billy would certainly have been equally eager to repudiate any attempt to place him on the right of the political spectrum. I wouldn't have accepted such a label either, but by this time I saw sweet moderation, not in terms of right or left, but in terms of right and wrong. If anything, I was a militant moderate. It was so often the case that those who postured and posed on the rostrum at our conference were the least effective in their branch. With no rostrum to shout from and no gallery to play to, when called upon to act as advocate or negotiator with the job of bringing round the person opposite to their opinion, many of them were incapable of protecting their members or advancing their cause. In 1987, I stood in the election to be a national officer and won. I was now an employee of the Union of Communication Workers rather than the post office. It was the end of an era for me. The business had changed more in the almost 20 years I'd worked for it than in the 100 years that went before. I'd changed with it. I'd joined as an 18-year-old postman, and I was leaving as a 37-year-old union official. I considered myself fortunate to have worked for such a fine institution. I had been proud to wear its uniform and grateful for the security it had provided, which had enabled Judy and me to bring up our three children free from the fear of unemployment. In the process, we'd grown apart, Judy and me. Perhaps it was inevitable, especially considering how young we had been when we married. I would come back to the Britwell from wherever I'd been, full of stories about the things I'd seen, the deeds I'd done, the people I'd met. Had I listened enough to her? Spent enough time talking about the changes in her life as she moved on from the playgroup to youth work? The yoga she was studying in order to become a fitness instructor? The new friends she'd made? Once, after she'd picked me up from Slough Station in her little Citroen 2CV, she began to cry. Apropos of nothing, out of nowhere, the tears rolled down her cheeks. But of course they hadn't come from nowhere. She was deeply unhappy with the life she now led, to all intents and purposes, alone. Natalie was 21 and married. Emma at 19 had a steady boyfriend. Jamie was about to sit his O-levels and spent most of his spare time out with his friends. Earlier in the year, travelling home by rail from North Wales, my train had been delayed by deep snow. I sat in the packed carriage, reading the collected works of Dorothy Parker. There was a short story set during the Second World War about a woman who goes to great lengths to prepare for the return of her American airman husband on leave. Despite her efforts, it is not a success, and she realises that he has a completely new life, while all she has is half of the old one. It hit me like a brick. On that train, staring out at the drifting snow, that was what had happened to us, to Judy and me. We'd done well together, the two of us. Most people who knew us hadn't expected the marriage to last anywhere near as long as it had, given all the circumstances. Now we talked things over and decided it would be best if we parted. And so we did. No longer a postman, I was also leaving the Britwell, which had been our much-loved home for 19 years. I packed up my books, records and clothes and carried them to the car. I loaded up and drove away, keeping my eyes firmly fixed on the road ahead.
Please, Mr. Postman, was written and read by Alan Johnson. It was abridged by Dan Vo and David Roper and was a Heavy Entertainment production for BBC Radio 4.
From the award-winning author of Cloud Atlas, an ambitious and intricate story of one woman's life, in her own words...
Jacko holds my wrist. Learn this labyrinth, Holly. So if you ever need to, you can navigate it in the darkness.
And the words of those who encounter her.
What is born must one day die. So says the contract of life, yes?
David Mitchell's The Bone Clocks, BBC Radio 4's Book at Bedtime.
I am here to tell you, however, that in rare instances this iron clause may be rewritten.
Starts on Monday night at 10:45.